Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to Patriot Nation Radio Live, 347-637-3942.
Right, number is 347-637-3942. This is the American Allegiance Show. Your host, Kevin White, retired military, Air Force. Shout out to everybody that served, all the veterans we're going to recognize tomorrow. It's awesome, isn't it? Well, today we're going to have some veterans on. We're going to talk about what it's like to be a veteran. First, I'd like to read just a little bit of this post that I hijacked from somebody else. Now, this is all true. To understand a military veteran, you must know we left home as teenagers or early 20s for an unknown adventure. And trust me, there's nothing more true than this. I was 18 years old. Next thing you know, I'm in basic training. I wanted to do it. I always knew I wanted to be in the Air Force, as my dad was in. And that's the reason I joined. There was no other option for me. Even if I wanted to go to college, that's what I did to get into college, to pay for it. And it's things like this that make me think, wow, I really did that. It's amazing, you know, that sometimes we do things and we don't realize. I had no idea what I was getting into. I went to Aircraft Electrical System School. I don't know how I passed through that. Sometimes you think back, that was hard stuff. That was difficult. Basic training was easy compared to that. But guess what? I got through. I made a career of it, and I enjoyed every minute. So I have no regrets, and if I could still be in, I would. So things like that are amazing. Okay, back to the reading here. We loved our country enough to defend it and protect it with our own lives. And that is so true. We put ourselves in harm's way. Not because we want to be heroes. It's because that's what we wanted to do. That we loved our country that much, and we were so patriotic about it. And that's what your job is every day in the military, is to defend the Constitution. Think about it this way. People salute the flag. People, you know, like our country. They talk about how much they love it, but we actually had to live it every single day. That flag was on our uniforms. It was on the planes because I was Air Force type. And it was everywhere on the vehicles. And you represented the United States when you went to war or exercises. You were the people that represented your country, and you proved it. And you loaded weapons or whatever you did, you launched aircraft against the enemy. So this is something that, just like in the Marine Corps or the Army, they do the same thing. Hand-to-hand combat, they've done it all. Some of the things my Army friends and Marine friends have done, I can't even imagine. But everybody has a place. Every service has its purpose. And the purpose of the Air Force was to destroy things from another country. I'll just put it that way. That's how I look at it. Moving on. So many things. When I was 18 years old, I was working on fighter aircraft. Hard to believe. After I got out of school, I went to Rickenbacker Air National Guard Base. I started my training there. And that's what I did on the weekends. And it was incredible. Now that I think about it, and I thought it was normal for a while there because all the military basic training and the tech school and then starting the new unit. I thought that's cool. Sometimes you think it's normal because everybody else is in the military when you're in the military. Just like when my dad was in the Air Force. I thought everybody was in the Air Force when I was a little military brat. Everybody was, in my eyes. And if you weren't, then kind of strange to me. Everything was about living on a base, serving, and everybody was so pro-American, so friendly, and everything like on a military base is like it's like a theme park for patriotism, because all you see are flags, red, white, and blue, everything. They repackage things just for the military, and that's what you see all the time. People don't understand. That's just the way it is. That's military life, and people get along great or else. That's the way it used to be in the 70s. If you had a racial problem with somebody else, they come and get your dad. whoever's in the military, and he would be punished. So they made sure that stuff didn't happen. So it was a completely different world. And so we're going to talk to some military vets and ask and talk about their careers. And I'm going to bring on, first, it's going to be Mr. Doobie Walden. He is a Marine. Marines never retire. Marines are always Marines. And I was talking to him earlier about this. Is that true, Doobie? Are you there?
Yes, that's absolutely true. It's an age-old saying, once a Marine, always a Marine. You never give up that title. It's something that you earned with your blood, sweat, and tears. And it can never be taken away from you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I know a lot of Marines. They tell me the same thing. And I've worked with a lot of former Marines who would tell you they're not former Marines. They're still Marines. And it's
absolutely.
Very
I was just about to correct you on that.
Yes. I've been corrected many times about that. So I understand.
It happens all the time. You see it on TV all the time. You see it in movies. A former Marine. There's no such thing.
Yes, and joining me with Doobie is Tracy Troxell, Chief Troxell of the 180th, former Air National Guard Chief, former Air Force, active duty, former fighter pilot, Crew Chief Extraordinaire. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. I like having former military guys on. We speak the same language. We understand things. The important things are, you know, little things don't bother us because we've been to places where the consequences don't mean anything now like they used to. So tell me about your thoughts about Veterans Day and being a veteran.
Well, for me, I mean, you know, having served 28 years in the military, I try to be what I would call a humble veteran, meaning you don't really run out on Veterans Day and try to grab every free lunch you can and everything. I think, you know, you sit back and you appreciate the work that you did for America and thank other veterans for their service, but expect nothing back in return for yours. You know, one thing, I read a book when I was younger, Andy Rooney, a book Andy Rooney wrote. And in the book was a quote, because he was a World War II guy. And in the book it said, the American veteran deserves nothing. They have what they fought for, a free country. And so that's always stuck with me. And whenever, you know, they salute the veterans and talk about Veterans Day, and somebody says, thank you for your service, what I always tell them is, I was happy to do it. And to me, that's really important, is that we should always be humble, but be happy to have, be proud of your service, but be happy to have done the job that you were supposed to do for America.
Yeah, absolutely. I always tell them when they say that, I always tell anybody that says that, it was my privilege to do it.
I say the same thing, you know, I say things like, you know, I would do it again if I could. And it's not about me. It's about what I wanted to do, what I believe in.
Yeah, Veterans Day, it's always seemed to me it was a day to get together with other veterans and my brother Marines and share the camaraderie and recognize, you know, what we had done and what we sacrificed to do it.
Absolutely. And by the way, today is the anniversary of the Marine Corps. All the Marines probably know all the dates and everything. And that shows you how much more, you know, close they are than the other branches, because they're right on it. Everybody's got their pictures up today. And I think it's amazing. They are a true brotherhood beyond what most military know.
It all started November 10th, 1775 at Tun Tavern, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The Marine Corps, the only service that was born in a tavern.
Nice. So, Doobie Walden, Everybody, I don't know if everybody knows this, but you are an angel dad, and you've been on a lot of national programs, and you know a lot of people, probably a lot of the same people I know, and your son was a Marine who was murdered two years ago, and I think he only got 30 days, the guy who did it only got 30 days or something. He didn't get much time, I can't remember. And I'm sure you were proud that your son became a Marine. You had a big influence on his life.
I'm going to tell you what. When Jimmy told me he wanted to go in the Marine Corps, I'll be honest with you, I tried to talk him into going in the Air Force.
Really?
My son was Jimmy was very intelligent. Jimmy was very smart. And I told him that, you know, the intelligent, smart man service was the Air Force. Every job in the Air Force has an equivalent job in the civilian world. And so basically, whatever time he spent in there would be training for his civilian career. And he blatantly flat out said, no, I'm joining the Marine Corps because you were in the Marine Corps.
That's pretty awesome.
To watch him walk across that grinder in San Diego and graduate, the same grinder that I'd walked across 35 years earlier, was one of the most emotional days of my life. And then Jimmy got to intel. He was working with the NSA at Fort Meade, Maryland. And I just, you swell. When they exceed anything that I ever did, you know, when your children exceed anything that you've done, it just makes your chest swell. And Jimmy went on a path to unlimited greatness. His NSA boss said that they were grooming him, that they wanted him after he got out of the Marine Corps. They wanted him as an asset. He had a future ahead of him that was just brilliant. It was all taken away in 1 second.
Yeah, that was a sad story.
It's bad enough. Anybody that's lost a child knows that pain.
Right.
That's bad enough. But my son was killed by an illegal alien who had no right to be here to begin with. And the state of Maryland knew that he was illegal 5 years prior to him killing my son. They arrested him 5 times in that 5 years and released him back into civilization, into the population. My son's death was 100% preventable. And that's where it stands. The guy, the only thing they convicted him of was leaving the scene of an accident involving a death. And he did 3 years and 5 months in prison in Hagerstown, Maryland. And he was released and deported. And as far as I know, he's supposed to still be in Mexico, but I wouldn't doubt that he's back.
That's a real tragedy. And, you know, the thing is, and I'm really impressed. I mean, he made you proud as a Marine.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Like I said, everybody, the Marine thing goes really deep. And I'm sure you're very proud of him, and he was proud of you, obviously. My dad was proud that I joined the military, you know, after he retired. And that was my plan all along. And, you know, it's good to see something about seeing your child or, you know, do the same thing, follow you because of that. It really means a lot.
And in this day and time, and I'm pretty sure that Chief's probably somewhere in around our age, for kids, our children, for their generation, to voluntarily join the service is a big deal.
Yes, it is.
There's a whole different mindset now. You know, there's so much nonsense being taught to these children in school, and there's so much brainwashing going on that they don't want to go in the military. They hate the military. They think the military is unnecessary. And they just don't grasp the fact that if it wasn't for our military, they wouldn't have what they have.
That's true. So I have a question for you and the chief. Okay. Speaking of that, you know, they talk about defunding the police. What, guess what's coming next? I'm pretty sure. I have an idea. It's possible. They've been saying the same thing about the military, and I know a lot of people in Congress are actually contemplating cutting funding, getting rid of, yes, getting rid of VA benefit. Go ahead, Chief.
Yeah, so I think that's kind of been going on all along. I started serving under Ronald Reagan. I served under five commanders in chief. And when I retired in 2015, and every year and every president that we ever had, the military got smaller and smaller, less capable, and more woke, I guess you could say. That's kind of what my guys are still in now start telling me about, but I don't really want to kind of talk about that as much. But it's
right.
You know, the military is, or the military, the Department of Defense is defined under the Constitution as one of the things that has to be funded. But to your point of it is, I don't know if it's a conscious effort, but, you know, it's been getting smaller and smaller the whole time. I mean, you know, when I was the command chief, we didn't get to go do anything that my predecessors got to do because we were in the continuing resolutions and all that other stuff. So, yeah, it's do more with less, more reliance on the guard to do the things that the active duty did, because the active duty had been, dwindled down so much. It's definitely a concern for the future about how the military is going to be funded.
Right. Do you remember 2014 or 2013, we had sequestration in the Air Force and all the Marine military. We went to Africa. We were the only people who were allowed to fly. It was the Air National Guard. No reserves, no active duty. We got over to Europe, and there all the planes were parked. And then we got to finally got to Africa. And all those people that the active duty there had to be activated. It was us, and it was the California Guard, and it was a bunch of guard fighter units. That was it, defending the entire world. That's back when the red line was drawn, and it was a dangerous act. I don't know if it was on purpose or not, but you remember the red line? We were in Africa. We had to move to another country to defend that. It was only the guard. We were it. Mm. So sometimes, only because of the way the budget was structured with the guard, nobody else could fly, and I don't know if it was done on purpose or not. I don't know. I don't like to think those kind of things, but it was really scary at that time. And then they took pay away from us when we got back. Sequestration did that. So we went in the hole just getting back from a deployment, and I thought it was disgraceful. It was disrespectful to the troops that just, you know, left the war zone. So in order to cover that, we did drills for everybody, you know, on a little TY. You don't have to go that far. That's not how you treat your veterans and the people in the military. And that was that government that we had back then that was responsible for that. We can't have that again, and that's what I'm afraid of is going to happen here in the near future, just like they did, like the guard people in D.C. A lot of stories coming out of there, very disrespectful. And like you said, Tracy, I think these things are getting worse. Even our own congressmen are treating them like dirt, from the reports I had from people that were there.
Look at the guys that went to guard the Capitol that they had sleeping in a parking deck while they were there defending the Capitol. And those were guard guys.
Right.
This step down, this breakdown of the military, this woke nonsense, and these weak generals that we have running things now that are more concerned with getting rid of political extremists out of the military than they are with defending this country are doing nothing more than weakening this country and opening it up to another attack similar to 9/11. And I hate to say it, and I hope I'm wrong, but I see it happening. I see another 9/11 coming. And they're so worried about political correctness and this and that and the other thing. And speaking solely for the Marine Corps, We had one mission, and that was it, and that was combat. That's the Marines' mission, is combat. That's what we do. And when it comes to that, and you talk about the brotherhood of the Marine Corps, that brotherhood is bonded by knowing that the man to each side of you has got your back, and both of them know that you've got theirs. And when you start all this woke pitting one group against the other and trying to talk about, I hate to say white supremacy, because that's just a key word for everybody now, but I don't know. There wasn't, in my view and in my time in, I was in from 79 to 89, I didn't see a lot of racism in the Marine Corps. I honestly did not. And that's all we talk about now, is the racism in the service. We didn't have time for it. We didn't have time for that nonsense. Everybody was green. It didn't make any difference where you were from, what your nationality was. Everybody was green.
Right.
And now, our politicians and our supposed leaders of the military are invoking problems. They're stoking the fire. And it does nothing more than weaken this country. Go ahead, Kevin.
I totally agree with that. And, you know, I worked many years with Chief Troxell, Tracy Troxell. And the job was to get it done. It wasn't about us. It wasn't about, you know, the people. It was all about getting the planes turned. And you don't have time to mess around with other things. It's the mission, right?
It's about the mission.
It's all about the mission. And that's the beauty of how that works. It's like the mission is to protect the president, not the guy in office, but the president, the office of the president.
Right.
There's a loyalty to who the president is. It's the position, his office. It's a very brilliant observation that, you know, that people actually see now. It's like people aren't loyal to people. They're loyal to the Constitution. That's the whole point. The Constitution is what runs. We are the defenders of the Constitution, and that's what this show is called, the American Legion Show. We are allegiance to this country. So, Trace,
absolutely.
You got any words?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, when you take the oath of enlistment, you swear an allegiance to the Constitution and the orders of the officers appointed above you, and, you know, and to the governor and to the president. That person's not named, like you said, and so, you know, we don't necessarily, especially as you kind of go higher into the watching the you know, how we make the sausage, as you would say, you know, as you say, you know, you have to set the political piece of it aside and know that you've got a job to do, and you've got an airman to protect, and you know, you got to make sure you get the job done for the American people. You know, it doesn't necessarily matter what political decision got you in whatever position you're in. You know, it's your responsibility to take care of the people around you and make sure you get the job done, because nobody comes and asks our opinion about whether we should go do X, Y, or Z or not. It's just, hey, time to go do it. And that's what, you know, the military does. We salute smart and we move out and take care of business. And so, you know, as you know, you can have your opinion on things, but, you know, you still have an allegiance and an oath of enlistment that you have to take care of, and that's what you go do, whether you like some of the stuff you're asked to go do or not, or who made the decision to do it.
Absolutely.
I tell people
you
that
know,
all the time, Tracy.
Yep. People don't understand, right? Tracy and I could be working on 701, which is your tail number if you had. And then 10 minutes later, we're cleaning the bathrooms. So nothing's a punishment in the military. You just do, that's your job. You paint the fences. You do whatever you have to do. We didn't have janitors or anything. For the longest time, it was just us. We did all that work. We did the yard work. We did all kinds of things that most people don't do at their jobs. and your job doesn't end at 8 hours or 10 hours. Sometimes you're working long, long hours. Sometimes you go to exercise at 3 a.m. in the morning, and it's just something you do, and you look forward to it. I mean, sometimes, like back in the old days, we'd have back-to-back drills. We'd have 19 days in a row. Sometimes you get tired of looking at the same people, just like a deployment. You get tired of the same people you see all the time, but, you know, it's what you got to do. You got to have your own escape. But it's all about dedication, and it's about teamwork.
That's true.
And when you're a different person when you're working on a mission. You're a different person. You focus on that, and you have your objective, and you get it done. That's what you do.
And as Tracy was saying, you know, your political views or your opinion, that doesn't matter, okay?
Yeah.
I tell people all the time, you know, the guys that came back from Nam, they got treated terribly.
Right.
And people don't understand when I defend them. You know, we don't set policy. We respond to appropriate orders. We complete the mission given to us to complete. We don't set policy. We don't do politics. We are a tool, a weapon, and we follow orders. That's what we do.
Right.
And cleaning bathrooms and mowing grass, painting rocks, okay? All that stuff comes along with the deal. You sign the contract, you're there. You don't have the choice of whether or not to accomplish the mission. It's accomplished the mission. Failure's not an option.
Absolutely. Yep. And if you notice, this is one of the things that I talk about. I talked about this in Florida. When the military leaves somewhere, it's cleaner than when they got there.
Yeah.
And when the military
Absolutely.
Does a job, yeah. Yep, and look at a base. The bases are pristine. I mean, it's just amazing.
Oh.
I mean, the manpower they have to put into that, everybody does it. Everybody in the enlisted ring is doing that job, and you see chiefs and everybody on that.
Every morning, we got up, we went to formation, we did our head counts, our rolls, and then everybody broke ranks, and we policed the area. You go around, you pick up cigarette butts, you pick up anything that doesn't grow goes. That's part of the job. Then you go to work and you do whatever it is your specialty is. You know, every week you
Right.
have a field day where you scour the barracks from top to bottom. You know, every Thursday night for us, it was field day. Friday morning was inspection. If you did not pass Friday morning, you did it again Friday night, and you didn't get the liberty. You didn't get a chance to leave the barracks until it passed. It's attention to detail.
That is true, detail. It's like, so Chief, I know you paid attention to detail because you made it all the way to Chief, and that's quite an accomplishment. I mean, you took a big change in your career. For that to happen, but you had that attention to detail, and just by the way you talk, I mean, you can tell you're a chief. You're up there because you're very eloquent on what you say, and you are in the right position for that. And so I applaud you for your accomplishments.
Oh, yeah, thanks, Kev. I definitely outkicked my coverage when it came to capabilities in the military. So, you know, the bigger thing for me in the service, because I had one goal when I joined the military and became a crew chief, is that when I retired, I wanted to have the same number of landings as takeoffs, meaning that, you know, I didn't
right.
have an airplane crash on me. And
right.
honest to God, that was the only goal I ever had. I just want, and I figured everything else would take care of itself. And we were, I was on an ADBON trip one time going down to Turkey when I was at Ramstein. It had been like 89, so it had been before any of this crazy stuff kicked off. And we were in the Incirlik Air Base bar and in the club. And it would have been 89, so I was probably just 19 years old, and we were doing gun smoke. And so me and this tech sergeant and our senior mass sergeant, who's our NCOIC of the gun smoke team, we were sitting in the bar one night, and he asked both of us, he's like, hey, what do you guys want to accomplish, you know, when you retire? The tech sergeant beside me, he's like, yeah, I want to make chief. And I'm like, yeah, I want to make chief. Yeah, I want to make cool. And And so old Bill Connolly, besides this, he puts out his Marlboro, you know, in his Johnny Walker red glass, and he goes, it's bullshit. He goes, if you work hard and you take care of your people, you never have to worry about where you get in the military. It will happen. People will recognize that and make sure you get the opportunity to excel and put you in positions that you might not otherwise wanted to necessarily do, but people will put you in those positions. And so that's what I always tried to do, is work hard and take care of my people as best I could. And I had some people who, you know, Lindsey Whitehead and Mike Massacre and Randy Karsten, who put me in positions and made me do things that I didn't necessarily want to do. But they thought it was good for me, good for the unit, and good for Mother Blue. And you know, they made me go do it, and it worked out. And you know, I said when I retired that, you know, if you see a turtle on top of a post, you know that turtle didn't get there by itself. And that's really, really true. You know, you have to have some people pushing you along the way for you to achieve anything. And so I was really fortunate in that aspect. You know, pushing 7 years now, I've been retired. Some days I miss it. Other days I don't. You know, people ask me, what do you miss about the military? And I'll tell them, you know, I miss the jets, some of the people, and my drill checks. And pretty much in that order, I guess. But, yeah, so it was a good time. And, you know, I did a lot of stuff, got to go a lot of places and do a lot of things I wouldn't necessarily otherwise have got a chance to do, and just thankful for the opportunity to have been able to do that.
Fantastic.
The thing I miss most about it, and I know you both understand what I'm saying when I say in the military things are in black and white. There's no gray. Okay, it's either right or it's wrong. It's either according to the UCMJ or against the UCMJ. When you get out and you come back into the civilian world, it's such a shock as to the fact that the entire civilian world is gray. There are no boundaries. There's no, you know, set right or wrong. There's no, you know, it for 7 years after I got out, my family said that I was not nice. I'll put it in clean language since we're on the air. That it took me 7 years to get over being a Marine or active duty Marine. And the things that you learn in there, when I went in, I was a 17-year-old punk kid. And it taught me discipline. It taught me leadership. It taught me acceptance. It taught me to operate on an even keel, to stay away from extremes. It taught you the different kinds of leadership. You know, there's authoritarian leadership and there's persuasive leadership, and you learn which one works with what people and how to address people and how to accept authority and use it correctly and, as Chief said, to take care of your people. That's number one. Nobody ever messed with my troops, ever. And they reciprocate that by following you into a hail of bullets and trusting you. Trust is a big thing.
I understand. I have a friend who was in the Army, and he was saying the same things you just said. They would go right against the bullets, or you know, their friends would be blown away or whatever, or their buddies. You had to trust your buddies more than anybody could imagine. I mean, your life depended on their lives and things like that we never saw in the Air Force. But my hats off to the Marines and the Army guys. It's just amazing how you guys, I mean, that's a really huge sacrifice. You don't know if you're going to come back. And that's,
I tell you,
but
I tell them all the time, if you've never been there, you'll never understand.
They say that the greatest generation was WW2, and I agree. But they're doing the same thing today. There's no difference between the Marines of today versus the Marines of then, or the Army, or anybody. They're doing the same thing. And we appreciate that. And people don't understand. This stuff is real. I know a lot of people went to Afghanistan, and their friends didn't come back. Their buddies and or Iraq. I mean, it's horrific. And they did it because they loved this country. They wanted to.
It's like you lose a limb. It's like losing a limb when you lose a troop.
And
Dubie really
and Chief knows this. He was an aircraft. That's the same way. It feels like you lost a part of yourself. And you know
that's
those cell numbers like you know other people. And I actually worked on the Afghanistan program. C208. I'm in a different department now, but same thing there. I mean, you lose things. That was a big disaster. I mean, I'm still mourning from that. That's something that never should have happened. But, you know, I got to get over this. And I wasn't even there. It's just that I was a part of that situation. And, I mean, it's just you live through other people. You're giving them advice and everything. You're trying to make sure things happen. And then this happens. It's a big letdown. It's like all the Marines that were there and the people that died. This is like unnecessary chaos that happened over there. We have people, Afghans that never got out, that were mechanics. So, and you know, you feel for them. And those are
our
people.
Vicariously. You live vicariously
right.
For your brothers. And one of the biggest hits that I took being stateside was when they blew up the barracks in Beirut and over 200 Marines were killed. That had the most horrendous effect on all of us, not just those that were there, not just the families of those that were there, but on all of us. Beirut ripped our guts out, and everybody, the day after it blew up, was volunteering to go. Send me. You know,
right.
Those are your brothers. You've lived together. You've trained together. You've worked together. You've become a cohesive unit. And all of a sudden, the heartbeat of that unit is gone.
Absolutely. Serious things. Those are some of the things I talk about, you know, are so consequential that we're worried about silly little things, you know, and we take things just to have freedom is a huge deal because we've been to countries that don't have freedom and we've seen things where, you know, we're downtown Turkey when a guy just wants to slap a woman, that's okay. Israel.
Yeah.
And nobody thinks anything of it. I mean, it's
women
just different cultures.
To go to school.
Right. Or, I mean, it's like that around the world, we have it made here. Casey, you can attest to that. We have it made at this point.
Yeah,
things don't go any worse.
That's good.
Yeah, I would love to be able to drop every person in this country over into the middle of Adana, Turkey, or somewhere in Iraq or Kuwait sometime, and have them get a taste of what it's like to not live in America once in a while. And they would, you wouldn't hear any complaining about living, being American or how bad they think they've got it here if they all had an opportunity to get over there and experience what that's like. And as an example, you know, over in Saudi Arabia back in Desert Storm, you know, everybody always made it out to be like Saudi Arabia was this, you know, really awesome place and how nice it was. And it was. Until you got off the main road by about 20 feet. And everything was just abject poverty over there except for the 4% of the country that was the ruling or the, you know, the royalty piece. Everything else was just dirt poor. And it really baffled me when I went over there because I'm like, that doesn't even seem right. That's not what I've been told. But the reality of that is that people would definitely be a little bit more appreciative of the gifts they've been given by being in America if they had an opportunity to see the rest of the world one time.
You've got an entire generation of kids now that weren't even born. They are coming of age. They're in their early 20s that weren't born when 9/11 happened. And they've never lived without a cell phone. They've never lived without a computer. They've never, you know, and they don't understand the freedoms they have. They don't understand how great it is to be in this country and to have what we have. And they get out and they want to preach this nonsense that's being taught in our colleges about socialism and this and that and the other thing. And they don't understand what it took and the sacrifices that were made by so many armed forces people to defend your right to stand up and be an idiot. And you have all this freedom, and you take it for granted because you've never been without it. Anybody that's been in the service knows that you give up some of your personal freedoms to be in the service. You basically have no, you know, your civil rights. You know, you live under the UCMJ. You don't live under civilian law anymore. And they don't understand that. They don't understand what it's like to not have everything they want at their fingertips. And they don't understand how fast it can be taken away.
Yeah.
If we don't support,
you know,
our military. We don't support our police officers. We don't support our first responders, firefighters.
Yes, there you go.
If,
you're on fire now.
If we
that's
don't support
absolutely
those
right.
people, it's all going to be gone. And you're going to be living in a grass hut eating your dead cat because you don't have food. Look
yeah,
at
you're absolutely right about that. And you don't have police, really. I mean, who would even think about that? I mean, who? That's law and order, you know. That makes no sense. You got to have
first of all,
protection.
They say, it's so silly. Yeah. They say defund the police, and we're going to replace them with somebody else. Well, all you're doing is making a new form of police. You're not getting rid
right.
of the police. You're just structurally destroying them and changing it.
Right.
It makes no sense, Kevin.
No, it does not.
I'm sorry. I get it all over.
Oh, no, you're good. Oh, that's all right. You know, I mean, the fact is that you and all the other veterans have sacrificed their lives, their place, their families or whatever, put themselves in harm's way and done what they had to do. You know, it's not, you get a deployment call, you're gone. We used to go on deployments. We'd fly 20 some hours to get there and go straight to work. You can't sleep on a plane. It doesn't matter. That's your job. You are an instrument, like
you
said,
about,
of government.
You want to talk about the sacrifices? Look at the divorce rate in the military.
Yes.
Look at the divorce rate of active duty military. They literally sacrifice their family because they have a mission
right.
and they sign a contract to do a job. And it's difficult to maintain a civil, decent relationship because it's two separate worlds. Like I said, the military is hardcore black and white, right, wrong, bingo. Then you go home to your wife and everything's different. And my first ex-wife accused me of talking to her like she was a private. And you know what? I probably did.
Right.
You
so
know, you come
hey,
home from newbie. That.
Yes. Yeah, when you came home one time from a war zone, I want to explain to everybody, this is one of the hardest things to do, to readjust back into society. People have no idea how, like for Tracy and I's example, all this afterburner activity and bombing over in another country, and then you get home and it's nothing. It's like people actually get depressed. And this is, so
yeah,
let me know.
Suicidal.
Doobie. Yeah, tell me about that.
You just, like I just said, it's two different worlds. And you are in a situation where you are, I don't know, you are at such a heightened sense of awareness.
Right.
Okay. That your nerves are constantly on edge. You don't get to relax. There's no sitting down, kick your feet up, drink a beer. There's no go hang out with your buddies at the pool hall. You are aware of everything. Situational awareness is a huge thing that they preach in the Marine Corps. Always know where you're at, who's around you, where the exits are, that stuff is impounded into your brain. And you come home and you see no discipline. You see no appreciation. You have lost your brothers. Either they're dead or they're somewhere else. You don't have that cohesive unit integrity anymore. And it's like being all by yourself in a crowded room. You can't connect with people. It takes a lot of time, a lot of personal discipline and growth to reintegrate. And the bad thing that's happening is, you know, you got guys that now, between Afghanistan and Iraq, have done 4, sometimes 5 tours. And you cannot bring those guys home without some kind of transitional care. You don't take a guy straight out of Iraq, bring him home, and drop him off in Yucca Buck, Iowa, and expect him to function like a normal civilian person.
I totally agree.
There has to be some form of transitional care. You bring these guys back, and you get them together, and you talk them down, okay? You've got to talk them down. You've got to get out of that fight-or-flight mentality.
Right.
And you have to learn how to be a person again. And they're not doing that. And it's hurting a lot of people. We lose 22 a day. Everybody knows that saying, 22 a day, veterans that commit suicide.
Right. Yeah. I have a lot of friends, I'm sure like you do too, and they're, you can tell by their signals and by posts on Facebook that they are really struggling. And this is years after they got out. Some of the things they've seen and done, it's very serious mental challenge for people to get over that, if they get over it. It's just, so the VA has a big, you know, they're talking about this and they're recognizing it now. And let's not talk about the VA. Okay. Hey, Tracy, you there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead, Kev. Don't get me started on the VA, dude.
Okay. You know, I understand. I hear it's actually better now, but I haven't seen much of that. So I spent a lot of time with the VA and in the military hospital, doctors are right, Patterson. Well, the point is people who are brilliant doctors don't go in the military or attorney, stuff like that.
Well, they go in there to do their internship.
They do. So, Tracy, tell me about your time, what your feelings are when you got back from a deployment, you know, all that stuff that you experienced, and then now you're home.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the first time I came back in 91 from Desert Storm, I mean, it was a little bit different because I was single. And so, you know, we had spent 6 months over in Khamis Mouche, Saudi Arabia, you know, eating MREs and near beers and everything like that. And I can remember getting off the airplane and all the other dudes were going to their wives and stuff. And I look around my other single bud and I'm like, you know what? I'm going to shop it and get a gallon of milk and chug it, because I hadn't any milk in 6 months. And
yeah.
And so, you know, that's the things you don't really think about. But I remember getting back from there, off the airplane, and the next, that was like, man, I don't know, maybe a Tuesday or something. The next Monday, I had a report for Airman Leadership School. So it was like, bing, bang, boom, you know, you're right there. But you know, like the times when we would go to Turkey and whatnot and other places and stuff. And it was always weird to me because, you know, one time we left, I don't remember when it was, but it was a Turkey trip. We were in the middle of launching the airplanes. And, you know, my jet's taxiing out, and I'm getting on the bus to go, you know, the jet's taxiing out to go do an ONW mission. I'm getting on the bus to go get on the airplane that's sitting on the other side of the ramp, you know, fly home. 14 hours later, you're back in your house, and you're like, what the hell just happened, right? I was just over there, right? So my hands still smell like JP-8, and And, and you get back, and it was right back into it. And the thing for me always was, and all the trips when I was gone, that when you're on a trip or deployed or whatever, it's relatively easy because you don't really have to think about too much. You just go to work 12, 14 hours a day, go to sleep, do whatever, have a beer, whatnot, right? But, your family back home, they're having to continue on normal life with one less person. And so it's really much more, it was always much more difficult for my wife than it was for us. And it's hard. You can't understand that. I mean, you can't express your understanding of that because they're back here with, the kid throwing up on the floor and the dog crapping out in the, out in the yard and that type of stuff and having to mow the grass. And so it's, to me, that's always trying to, express to my wife that I understood what she was going through, but even though you couldn't, and so, it was always nice to come home. You're always thankful that you get home. It's part of the job and things you got to do. And as you were talking earlier, about 9/11 and all that. And I have a little different frame of reference on it because when I joined the Air Force in 1988 before anything went on, and August 2nd, 1990 hit, and we had been, and I always thought, hey, man, hopefully we get to go drop some bombs and kill some people someday and do some of that cool stuff. And then August 2nd, 1990 hit when Iraq invaded Kuwait, and it had been pretty much go time for that entire time. So when the new airmen on their first drill into the unit, I would get the colonel would brief them, and then I'd get to talk to them for a little bit, and I'd always tell them that what they're doing is very momentous and something that no other generation has ever realistically had to do very much, is that they're joining the military in a time when we've been at war longer than some of them had been alive. And
absolutely.
And I would tell them that was a very special thing that they do, because when I would use myself as an example, and I would say, look, when I joined up, we thought the Russians would blow us up, right? We didn't have any of this other stuff. And so, and you know as well as I do, Kevin, some of our folks in the military, if you joined after 1990 and you retired anywhere between then and last year, right, or 6 months ago, you spent your entire career in a military that was at war the entire time. No generation in this country has ever had to do that. And I would talk to them about how special their service was. And I would say, and I always ask, because it's the Air Guard, and Ohio's got some really good, tuition, assistance. And I would tell everybody, and a lot of times the parents would be in the back of the room, and I would be like, hey, I'd be like, how many of you all in here? And there'd be 25, 30 every drill in the student play. And I'd be like, how many of you all joined this? For the benefits to go to college. And usually 90% of them would raise their hands, And I would tell them, okay, that's awesome. That's great. I'm happy for you and that's perfectly part of the deal. I'm more than happy to pay for you to go to college. Perfect. We're going to get our work out of you, but that's the deal. I said, but there's going to come a time when instead of you thinking you're going to be sitting yourself down at Bowling Green State University for the next 6 months, I'm going to knock on your door, and you're going to go with us over to Bagram Air Base, Afghanistan, and we're going to go kill the enemy and blow stuff up. And you better be prepared to do that, because you didn't join the Cub Scouts. You joined the military, fighting military organization, and the purpose of us, our job, is to break things and kill people. And if anybody's not prepared for that, let us know now, because we can help you out before you go and we spend any money on you. And sometimes you get a little funny look with people, but I would have some people every now and then, a parent in the back of the room would stop me on the way out and they'd say, you know what, dude, thanks for telling them that, because I've been trying to tell my son or daughter how that exact sentiment, but they didn't listen to me. They didn't understand it, because you're not joining the Cub Scouts when you join the military, and it's important that everybody understands that.
That hits so close to home. I got out in 89, and I went back to work building houses with my family, and I had a cousin that was working with us, and he hated what we did. He didn't want to be a carpenter. He wanted to get an education. So what does he do? he joins the Air Force. And I talked to him. And, you know, he's, well, I'm going there. I'm just going to get my 4 years of college and get my education, and then I'm out. And I told him before he ever went, I said, dude, you're not signing a college contract. You're signing a
right.
contract to join the military. Okay, you are signing right. a contract to give 4 years of your life to defend this country. Oh, nothing's going to happen. No, no, no. He went through basic. He went to his A school or training school or whatever you guys call it in the Air Force. And as soon as he got out, boom, Iraqi freedom. And here he was right in the middle of it. He never got one day of college the 4 years he was in.
Wow.
And he looks at me and goes, you know, I should have listened. Well, yeah. you should have listened.
So back in,
it's not the Cubs.
Back in the 80s, back in the 80s and 90s, the Guard would actually advertise nothing but college, college, college. They didn't give it the other side, even though you got fighter jets and tankers on the flight line. It was just a weekend job. I know a lot of people who got out as soon as they got their degree. And my thoughts were they got what they advertised. So that was a big mistake. They backed off that. Now it's a little less, but that was the entire crux of recruiting was college, free college, free college. We pay you every month.
Look at the commercials the Army's got on right now. Join the Army and become a neuroscientist. Join the Army and become an electronics engineer. There's a very small, minute number of people that get into those MOSs. Okay, the rest of them are going to be ground-pounded grunts. They're going to be arty. Yeah. They're going to be a mortarman. But all they advertise is the glory jobs.
Right.
False advertisement. In my opinion, it's false
speaking of... Somebody here, I think it was you, Jimmy, you brought it up that you go there, you learn a skill, and, you know, I learned aircraft maintenance. I was able to get a job at an airline after I got out, and now I work for the government as a contractor. And, I mean, the continuity is there, but the difference is, I'll let you know, Tracy, the dedication isn't the same. The dedication is a lot more. People are more concerned about the mission getting planes fixed in the military than they are anywhere else. That's just how it is.
Yeah.
And you never lose that. You started working on an airplane again, Tracy, you'd be completely different because that's what you did. This is the way you do things. But it's not like that in the civilian world. They're not so concerned with planes as much. Exactly.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting that one of our old chiefs, you know who he is, Kevin, he and I work at an aviation museum near here. He and I have a whole total different way of thinking about aircraft maintenance than the guys that were there before. And God bless them, but they didn't have any military experience. They're really awesome dudes. Just the way you were taught how to do things is totally different. And so we've, you know, mostly him, but, you know, I kind of help out when I can to, you know, totally upgraded that operation over there. And, you know, because it's just, that's the culture. That's how you learn how to do things. You don't know that there's any other way to do it. So, yeah.
So, right. And I never got an A&T license, but I worked in the engineering department. I was troubleshooting at American Airlines. I was in that department where there was a lot of military guys in there that were doing the same job I was, former military. And it was like, we had a team. We understood, you know what I mean? We had the connections. And that was completely different than working with the people who were not. So, and we had Marines and Navy, Air Force, and, you know, it was a team. And it felt different than normally does. So I work with the government. It's not the same unless I have military, because we have that understanding what the mission is, and we want to get it done. We want to get it done better than, you know, it's given to us.
It's discipline.
That's right, it is.
Discipline and attention to detail.
And those civilians, Kevin, don't have a mongoose.
They don't have what?
They don't have a mongoose like we had.
Oh, my goodness. You know, those are good memories. That was the guy in our shop.
Sounds like there's a story behind that.
John Mertz. was the EE environmental guy. Yeah, he did the oxygen, nitrogen, and he converted to an EE guy, electric guy, aircraft electrician. Yeah, he was Mr. Wildman from the woods. And he, you know, he'd find dead bodies out in the field, and he'd go out and he'd shoot down geese flying over the base. And next thing you know, it's in the sink in the battery shop.
But yeah, I remember
he knew
that.
Everything.
IFE, yeah.
He knew everything there was about surviving in nature. So he was saying, you got to eat this, you got to do this, you got to do that. And he proved it. He was also a scavenger. He, you know, he'd bring stuff back and rebuild it. Oh, my God. It was like, what are you doing? But, you know, he outranked us all, so it's okay.
Yeah.
Yes?
We used to say if there was ever a nuclear war, there'd be the cockroaches and Mertz would be left.
That's right. He would.
And Betty White. And Betty White.
And Betty White. Yeah, I talk to McMillan all the time. We're good friends on Facebook, Tom. So, yeah, unfortunately he passed away a few years ago. I saw him in the hospital before that happened, and yeah, great guy.
You guys hadn't worked together. How long had it been since you worked together, but you still felt that connection?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, that's the way it is. I mean, you feel for people you haven't seen for a long time, and because you did a lot of things together. I mean, you slept together, you showered together, you spent hours and hours and days and weeks and months together, and those are your people. That's your other family. And you know, everybody has an order, and everybody understands, like you said, it's black and white. It's either this or it's not. And that's how they run. And that's the key, because the military is a dictatorship. And this is one of the things, I have a book I'm working on. It's going to be called How the Government Doesn't Work, What the Military Does. And you see no discipline. The Congress and the Senate and your governors and everybody's rogue. Nobody pays attention. They all take the oath of the Constitution, but they don't follow it. It's all, you know, their clearances are given to them. It took me a while to get my clearance back. They looked at everything I did. Mm-hmm. But if you're a congressman or senator, oh, here you go. You got a full top secret, unlimited clearance. And our Marines, our Air Force, Army, and Navy, we have to work for ours. We have to get ours the hard way. We have to earn it because it's that important. But it's not that important when you're in politics for some reason. The people
you
who
have
actually
to earn that trust.
Everything. Right, right.
You have to earn the trust to get the clearance. You have to prove that you're reliable. You have to prove that you're trustworthy. You have to prove that you have integrity. Whereas the figureheads, it's just given to them, just like you said. It's just here. You have full access to all of our top secret information.
Right. And you're doing some very serious.
You got them sleeping with Chinese spies, you know?
Yes. Right. Or their car driver. I don't know. I won't mention her. Is a Chinese spy. But there's a lot of things. People think you get in the military and you're good. No, there's a lot of hoops you got to jump. You got to make your ranks. You got to your PMEs or your schooling and everything. You have to be on it. And it's turned a lot more academic since I got in. So you have to pass on the history of your continuous. And the things are, some things aren't easy. You know, you have to really, that's what you got to do. You got to study, and you're actually a lot of things I learned from my PME, my schooling I had in college. It was the same stuff, and I was like, wow, they really got it together in the military. A lot of the concepts and the people, things I learned, I already knew about. So they're doing a good thing. They pay for college when you get out.
Intelligence based. Becoming a lot more intelligence based.
Right.
I say they're not looking to recruit the hardcore ground-pounding grunts anymore. They want people that are technologically savvy. They want people that have computer knowledge. They want, you know, they're looking for a different group of people because warfare has advanced. Okay, technology has advanced. But you're never going to get away from boots on soil and the grunt.
Right.
You need those people. You need those people. You need the guys that will go chew up a barbed wire fence and spit out bullets. And they, the way the things, the way they come across now is that those people are bad. You know, those people are a lesser society or something.
Right.
I don't like the way they're going about recruiting. I don't like the way they're going about segregating and separating our ranks. Everybody knows
right.
everybody. You know, we all make fun of each other. The Marines make
yes,
fun of the Navy and the Air Force and the Army makes fun of the other ones, and we all have the jokes. And that's all fine
right.
and dandy when we're in peacetime and we're in the barracks shooting at breeze. But when the caca hits the fan, it takes all of us. None of us can do it on our own.
And we
everybody
work together
to
seamlessly.
On everybody.
Seamlessly work together
when you're in that situation.
Because when you guys want those A-10, when you want those A-10, they're there.
We need a warthog. We need a sortie. Okay, let's go. And you can be working right next to a guy that's in the Air Force, and you don't look at him like a guy in the Air Force, and he don't look at you like a guy
right.
in the Marines.
Right.
Okay. You
yep.
look at each other as comrades. We got to get this job done.
Exactly. People don't understand. We work together seamlessly during wartime and exercises. We see all the services, even all the other countries. We're there all together, you know, doing the mission. Like, if, you know, I don't – the logistics of it seem impossible, but I've seen it happen. It's the
it
top
works.
Level is incredible. So, Tracy, I got a question for you. Remember the quality – the people that were pilots, fighter pilots, are – they're doctors, they're veterinarians, they're engineers. People would be surprised
oh, yeah.
in flying those airplanes.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, you know, in the active duty, you know, everybody's full-time, you know, active duty, right? So, but in the Guard, it's a totally different animal. And you know, even the airmen, but, you know, to your question of a lot of the pilots, yeah, I mean, we had some airline guys. We had a veterinarian, we had a doctor, yeah, I mean, you have all kinds of different guys, these dudes that, you know, didn't do anything, right? They were just guard bums and stuff. And, you know, and so that was always, that's the interesting piece of the culture of the Guard. That's a lot different than the Air Force, you know, and, you know, there was, you know, and the other part of it is the enlisted folks in the Guard are generally, because they have civilian jobs or, you know, they're a lot of times they're at a higher education level just from they've gone to school longer, they're older or whatnot than a lot of the active duty folks. I mean, there was a weapons guy who's a veterinarian, you know. You know, we've got one of my old chiefs, he runs an entire test section for the government down at a test place in Virginia. And then, you know, he has a budget that is three times what the budget was out at the Guard base in Toledo. And, you know, people, you know, it is what it is. It's just a little bit different animal from that standpoint, but it's part of what makes in the Guard specifically, you know, the culture so much different than active duty from that standpoint. But yeah, it's kind of a cool concept, you know?
Yeah. Cause I remember when, I had engineers in my shop, in the electric shop, that worked for me, you know, just on the weekend because they wanted to do it. And that's – I love that because you have a citizen that puts his job away, picks up the gun, and then does his job. And because that's a true citizen guardsman, military citizen. And I like that because these guys are making so much money. They're losing money on drill weekend. And they have so many skills and abilities. They don't have to be there, but they want to. And that's incredible to me. And just like Lance Danmeyer, for example, the guy does really well. Or even you when you, mm-hmm. you know, you were doing that. And they love it. They want to do it. And they look forward to every drill weekend. And it's incredible. Those are heroes to me. It was my full-time job. I loved doing what I did. But I was amazed that these professionals are coming in and, you know, putting themselves in harm's way. They'll go on the trips and everything, and they come back, and it's just amazing to me. And they love it. They enjoy it so much. You would think, you know, it's an escape. I'm sure it's an escape. Just like you had an escape from your working for your job when you became a weekender.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you look forward to all the drills you went to.
Yeah, unfortunately, though, as my career ended up, my part-time job was a full-time job. And, exactly right. So, but, yeah, I mean, it was kind of always a pain because you had to go to drill when you worked all your other, you know, your other job. And you know, the guardsmen didn't get a day off before or after drill, you know, a lot of times like the full-timers did. But that's the choice we made, you know. But it was always a nice break to go out and go do something different. And then to me, the greatest thing about drill weekend was in the morning when I'd get up, you know, because I didn't wear the uniform all month long because I was, you know, a civilian at that point. But I get up for drill weekend, I put on my uniform, and then that feeling of, you know, what it was like active duty and the pride and the reverence for the people that have come before you was a fantastic feeling, you know. And it was the same feeling I had, you know, the day I took my uniform off for the last time. You know, it's like, hey, this is it, dude. You don't get to do this anymore. And I made a pact then that with myself and with my wife that a lot of guys will wear, you know, when they're retired, you're allowed to wear your uniform to different things.
Right.
And what I told her is I'm like, look, here's where I'm putting this stuff. The next time I will put this on is when you slit the back of it and put me into it when you got to fit me into a coffin, because to me, that I always want to maintain that feeling of what it was like the day I took my uniform off for the last time. And I don't want to, and God bless people that do that. That's fine if they want to do that. But for me personally, I want that to be that memory that I have, how that feeling. I don't want to, sully that feeling, right, that memory I have by doing it some other time for that. But yeah, it's a great, great thing.
Yeah, I have never put my uniform back on. I feel the same way. Even though, you know, and Doobie, you could answer this. We used to go, I don't know if you experienced this, but I would go to lunch or somewhere in my uniform and I'd be completely different. People saw me differently than just being black. I was a military member, and it's one of the things that I totally escaped anything, because I would go to small towns or whatever, and they would buy me lunches or stuff like that. I mean, people would, hey, want to buy you something, or they paid for something I'm already eating or something, or I'm ordering, because, you know, they have the respect for the military. I love it. And military towns are great. That even happened in Toledo. And you know, that's just one of the perks. Yeah.
I wasn't even in uniform. I was in an all-marine motorcycle. I was in an all-marine motorcycle club called 11X Motorcycle Club. And I was at lunch with a buddy of mine one day, and I had my vest on, my colors on, and we were sitting there eating lunch, and the waitress came over with this napkin and handed me the napkin. And I opened it up, and there was like a two-paragraph note inside this napkin thanking me for my service and that he bought mine and my buddy's lunch. And now, as far as me, as far as I know, it's still that way in the Marine Corps. You're not allowed to go out to lunch in town in your regular camouflage uniform. You're not allowed to. You don't get out, pump gas. You don't do anything when you're in camis. So if you went out to lunch, it was drive-through for us.
Right.
I see a lot of our guard guys here in town. Our guard guys that go to lunch, and I'll run into them someplace, and I buy a lunch every now and then. But we also have a Marine detachment here, permanent personnel, active duty, that run a reserve unit here, and they still, you do not see them out in town in their camis.
They changed that rule for the guard too. That's why, yeah, the guard changed that. Air Force changed that completely. Because they understood, what are you going to do, change your clothes before you leave work or you're out in the middle of nowhere? So it made more sense. And, you know, the uniforms are universal. Pretty much the Air Force and the Army are the same. They wear the same uniforms all the time. They switch back and forth. So
yeah.
People don't realize that. We are pretty much the same, just a branch.
Yeah.
What do you say, Tracy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, if you're wearing, this is the old first sergeant's going to come out of me here, but if you're wearing the uniform properly and not walk around with your hands in your pockets and your hat on like you're going to a baseball game, you should be proud of that uniform and be happy to wear it out in public, and because you're representing the America when you do that, and the people, the taxpayers, mm-hmm. you know, they want the ability to be able to see, you know, their men and women in uniform, and people should be, I never agreed with it that you shouldn't do it. I think that's a little bit ridiculous, but yeah, absolutely. I mean,
I agree with you totally. I agree with you totally. I thought it was a ridiculous rule because, like, you know, what if you run out of gas? You got to call somebody to bring you gas because you can't get out and go to a gas station in your camis. It was a ridiculous rule.
Uniform of the day.
Yes, sir. And
we see it all the time. I work close to Wright-Patterson. I went to Wright State, and we see that all the time. Air Force wears them all the time out in public.
Now, if we were in dress uniform, if for some reason our uniform of the day was our Charlie's, which is a short sleeve shirt with the trousers, then you could get out. If you were
really?
In a dress uniform, you could get out.
Yeah.
You could go into a restaurant if you were in a dress uniform. But in our utilities, our work uniform, you didn't. Which makes no sense either.
Right.
It's the way it was. We had guys that would put sweatpants on over their camis and take their blouse off, and they'd just be sweatpants and a green T-shirt. Everybody knew what they were doing, but
really,
they would do it to go to lunch.
Oh, interesting. Ah.
Loophole.
Yeah, I can understand it being a problem. I remember when we couldn't do that either. You could only stop at gas station, and you were so limited at one time. It was like, oh, you know, whatever. Just go ahead and wear it.
Well, like I say, I got out in 89, so it was quite some time ago.
I got in in 85.
It was different. And when I was at Lejeune most of my time, Lejeune or surrounding base, New River Air Station, Cherry Point. And to be quite honest with you, the people of Jacksonville, North Carolina, where Camp Lejeune is, didn't much care for us. Even though, you know, there was, I want to say, somewhere around 100,000+ Marines in the area between Cherry Point, New River, Lejeune, Geiger, they didn't particularly like us. I do understand part of why. I mean, you got the 10% that go out and make a complete idiot of themselves
yeah.
and tear up people's property and get drunk and act like an idiot and harass people. But they judge us all on those 10%.
Right.
So that was my experience with it.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
Again, it was pre-9/11, and it was pre-Iraq,
right.
pre-Afghanistan. There's a lot more respect for those guys now. They came back to parades, and they came back to people that were proud of them, and that all changed, you know, when we did go into Iraq the first time, and Afghanistan, and, you know, it changed people's outlook on the basic, you know, troop. And I'm proud of that. And I tell them guys all the time, be proud. Take that recognition. Because there's people that came back to getting spit in the face and, you know, burning their uniforms and because they weren't appreciated.
I agree. I have a guest who I'm bringing on sometime in the future, and this guy was a, you'll love this, he was a Vietnam F-4 pilot that got shot down. He did 89 missions and got shot down. And I met him down in Florida back in April. I did a speech down there.
Is he the one that was in the Hanoi?
Yes. Yes, Smith.
I've got his book in my table right here.
All right. This guy spent 5 years in the Hanoi Hilton, Tracy, and he has nothing to complain about today. He said it was the most horrific conditions. Yeah, I heard it. You heard a speech, Doobie, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I talked to him outside.
Awesome. Yeah, I was on a show with him once. I was impressed, and I met him. I sat next to him at that event. So this guy gets back on the C-141 from Wright-Patterson, which is that Hanoi, whatever they called it. I can't remember what it was called. The Hilton, I believe, something like that.
Yeah,
the Hanoi Hilton. He has no complaints at all. And he's like, well, you know, that's what happened. And there's a lot of guys that are like that you would think would be bitter. And that's one of the questions he was asked. Are you bitter from that? Well, you know, that's just what happened, and I don't hold anything against them, and they were doing what they were following orders. So his mind is like, he knows what the other side was doing. They were following the orders. Even though they were wrong orders or whatever, he learned to live with it. He made his own shoes, and they had this tapping thing that they tapped on the pipes. They communicate. These are people who are so – they adapt and overcome. That's what I'm trying to get at. In those circumstances where most people would not. So, and you tolerate things a little more. The military guys can handle that boredom probably more than most, because that's a lot of the time your career. You got nothing to do. You're waiting for something to happen that doesn't happen quick. So I'm going to have him
Wayne
on.
Smith.
That's right, Wayne Smith. And his wife, Lewis Bolin. They're very awesome people. Anyway, I'm going to have him on my program. They've already agreed to it. I find a date for that when they're ready.
Fantastic.
So stories like that, I love to hear. And I dedicated, I have my speech, I even mentioned him. He's one of the heroes. And I totally respect all the people that were there that were vets. We had the big vet line stand up in the front. We were in front of like 250 people. That was awesome. Yeah. I really appreciate that. And the love for
I'll tell you what,
the
he
best
was,
and understanding. Yes.
He was an incredible man to talk to.
Yeah.
I've never seen a more gracious and more grateful man in my life. I mean, it was incredible. Just to be in his presence gave you goosebumps.
Right, right.
He's just that kind of guy, you know? And what a positive attitude that he had.
And just on that note there's a lot of people, the best people I've ever worked with have been military guys, heroes. I mean, people that are like beyond reproach, people that so much integrity and you know, and they keep going over and over again. They try. I mean, there's some things. We did a lot of complex things working on jets, very complex things. People would have the tenacity to go and go. And I learned a lot of people like that. They just keep going until they get it. Just keep going until they get it. And you don't know what the problem is. Complex fighter jets are no joke. You don't know. Some of the parts actually make decisions on their own. And you have to outsmart those parts. So, and like I say, I mean, that's just one of the things. You have people like that, and people who are rocks, and they're teaching you things. My first trainer told me, you can't just put the parts together. You have to gingerbread it. You have to make it look like it came from the factory. And that's what I did. I learned so much from great people. And I'm thankful for that. They're not around anymore, but I have gotten so much knowledge. And working with other people that do the same thing, like people like Tracy, and, you know, everybody that works together to make it all happen. And it's just the feeling you get, and you know, it's going to come out all right because you trust people. Just like in the Marine Corps, you trust your buddies in the Army and the Navy.
Yep.
And there's nothing – I haven't felt that. outside of the military. I've never felt that. That there was a super team of experts. And that's what it was. We had, like Tracy, you could say something about this. We had nothing but pros and experts in every, pretty much every fighter squadron or tanker or whatever. You got complete pros that can do sheet metal and everything else like nobody's business.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, and it was the dichotomy between an active duty maintenance unit and a guard maintenance unit is pretty vast, really, because, you know, in an active duty unit, you know, guys would come in, you get new airmen and whatnot, and you'd be there maybe 2, maybe 4 years or whatever, and you move on to another assignment and whatever. But in the guard, you know, there are guys that were working, that worked there for 40 years and had immeasurable amounts of maintenance experience and just general experience in doing stuff, right? And so, you know, when I became a full-timer at Toledo in 94, I was the first guy who had been hired on the flight line since Mike Bratton had been hired in like 1987. And so it was he and I were the only guys that were under 30 years old at the time, and everybody else was like 45, yeah, 50 years old, all those old timers, you know. And I can remember coming off active duty, and I walk in and I was like, holy crap, man, what's going on here? You know, these dudes have been retired 20 years, you know, if they were on active duty. But the ability and the experience that they had, you know, is immeasurable. And that's, you know, that's one of the great things about the Guard is that, and that's not quite the same anymore because everybody's a little bit more transitory now. But yeah, I mean, back in those days, it was amazing that some of these dudes, some of these guys worked together for 25, 30 years. You know, just not on airplanes, but the same group of 15 guys. So it was amazing, you know, to see all that.
Right. And I can go to the sheet metal shop or machinist, and all those guys are pros. And it's just amazing, all those years of experience. And they put it to work every day, and they got skills. Yeah. And I have friends today that are ex, you know, military, and they still have those skills, and that's where I get a lot of my car work done on my Mercedes, by the way. A lot of things I piece out. So it's good to have friends that have skills like that. So we're at the end of the show now. If you guys want to make some departing statements, we have 2 minutes left. If you go ahead. Who wants to go first? Anyone?
Go ahead, Chief.
Go ahead, Dewey. No, go ahead. You're first.
Okay. I just want to say happy birthday, brothers, Marines.
Yes.
God love you. Keep you safe. Happy Veterans Day to everybody that's ever strapped that thing on. I love you, all of you, and I hope that everybody appreciates the sacrifices that we do and that what all of us have done. And as Tracy said earlier, remain humble. And I appreciate you letting me come on, Kevin.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I've had you on a couple of times before. It's a pleasure. Go ahead, Tracy.
Yeah, and same for me. You know, I mean, you know, it's kind of the same sentiments there as, you know, appreciate the ability that veterans have to have been able to serve their country, and more so appreciate the freedoms that we have from that service, and that's what's important. And thanks to you, Kev, for having us on here, and appreciate it from that standpoint as well.
And I'd like to have you guys back again for other whatever topic or something we do in the future. So we do this every Wednesday night at 7 o'clock. I went an hour and a half tonight, and the program is shut down in 1 minute. So I appreciate you guys coming on, and God bless the USA and our troops out there right now. And sometimes it's a hard life. It's a lot of things to handle. And but, you know, you got your buddies, you got your friends, and, you know, if you think about suicide, get some help. Look, I don't have the number with me right now, but people get some help. It's a serious problem, and, you know, we got to protect our own, and we got to take care of their six and our six too. So thank you, everybody. Appreciate you listening tonight, and we didn't have time for callers. Just want to focus on our veterans today. And all you veterans, have a great Veterans Day tomorrow. And we will always honor you. So good night, everybody. Take care. See you later.
Night.